lead pastor, and I'll be sort of wrapping up the talk today. So grab your note sheet, grab a pen, relax, grab coffee some more if you want to. And here comes Andy Stanley. He's got the message today.
This summer, our family did something I've been wanting to do for a long time. I'm the dad who thinks you should never take kids on a vacation they're not old enough to appreciate. So I made a rule in our family, we're not going to Disney until everybody can walk. We do not stroller through Disney, okay? I would see people stroller through Disney and think, what? They're not going to remember it, and you're not going to like what you do remember, and you cost a fortune to get you in this park. So we were the, hey, when you can walk, we go to Disney World. So I said to Sandra, if your parents want to take them, fine, I'm not going. Okay, well, I'm going, so I'm that dad. So anyway, you can discount that. So the point is, the other trip that I wanted our family to take is I wanted to take my kids. We have three kids, two in college, one a senior in high school. I wanted to take everybody to two cities in the world in this order. I wanted to take them to Jerusalem, and I wanted to take everybody to Rome, and I wanted to do it on the same trip. I didn't want to go to the Holy Land. I mean, I've been to the Holy Land, but I wanted to go to Jerusalem, then I wanted us to get in a plane and go to Rome. And I wanted to connect these two dots for my kids because they're just extraordinary, extraordinary cities. They're at the epicenter of so much of history, but more importantly for me, they're at the epicenter of our faith. So we began, so we did that this summer, that in June we did. So we started off, we flew in to Tel Aviv and went to Jerusalem, spent several days in Jerusalem, went down to the Dead Sea just for fun and Masada and all that cool stuff. But here, and then while we were in Jerusalem, because when you go to Jerusalem, there's several things you have to see. And one is the Garden Tomb, which could be the place where Jesus came out of the tomb. Some of you have been there, there's a picture of the Garden Tomb. But let me tell you what was so cool about our trip. We went in June. No one's there in June because it's about 150 degrees. You can't survive. I mean, it was so hot. I remember growing up when you hear your dad say, it's so hot, I got to sit down. You're like, what's up with you? I understand. It's so hot, I got to sit down. Go find some shade. So nobody was there. So literally, when we went to the Garden Tomb, and I've been before where there's buses outside, there's groups moving through, we were literally the only people there. There was a couple leaving when we got there, and so the five of us had all this time in this very, very amazing, amazing area right outside the walls of Jerusalem. We had communion together right here in the Garden Tomb, and you're thinking, well, of course, you're the preacher. You'd make your kids have communion, but no. When you go to the Garden Tomb, they sort of make you have communion, so it wasn't just me being the preacher. So we had this amazing moment. We prayed together. It was so powerful. But the thing that I wanted to just bear down on my children, and because I'm the pastor, they're used to me talking about this stuff, is we're outside the walls of Jerusalem looking at the city, and to say to them, now here's what I want you to imagine, okay? This place is kind of worthless. I mean, it's a dust bowl. It was the armpit of the Roman Empire. It wasn't strategically important. They couldn't grow anything there. It's like, look how just vast and desolate this whole place is. And just a little ways north of here, one day Jesus is standing with his 12 disciples. And he says, hey, who do people say that I am? And they said, well, they think you're the reincarnated Jeremiah or one of the prophets or Elisha. Some of them think you're John the Baptist. And Jesus said, who do you guys think I am? Now, this is amazing. And Peter said, we think you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, you know. And Jesus turns to Peter, and there's just 12 of them. They're out in the middle of a desert area looking at this city out in the middle of nowhere. And Jesus says, on that idea right there, I'm going to build my church. Right there, that statement, that I'm the Christ, the Son of the living God. I'm going to build a growing gathering of people. And nothing, not my death, not your death, no one's death, nothing is going to stop it. He made that statement not too far from here. And of course, the 12 disciples looked at each other like, well, there's like 12 of us and like nobody cares. Nobody's ever heard of you. And you're going to build a gathering. I hope that goes good for you. I don't see that really happening. And the little word that he used, the little word, when you read your English Bible, it says, I'm going to build my church and the gates of hell won't stand against it. The little Greek word is the word ekklesia, and it really means gathering. Now, unfortunately, the word church is a German term. It's not even from a Greek word. It's from a German word that's from an older German word that's from a Danish word that's from a sort of a Saxon word that comes from a completely different Greek term that means it means a place of God or house of God. But the word that Jesus used, the idea that Jesus conveyed, ekklesia, was a gathering of people. That Jesus predicted a gathering. He did not predict a place. He predicted a people. He didn't predict, hey, there's going to be a building on a corner. There's going to be a building in an intersection. There's going to be a cathedral. He didn't predict any of that. He said, I'm going to build a gathering of people. And it's going to be a growing gathering of people, and nothing is going to stop it. And again, they're standing out in the middle of kind of nowhere. And they're like, really? Like, how are you going to do that? There's 12 of us, and most of the people inside the cities don't even like you. How is that going to happen? And that's exactly what he did. In fact, if you're a Christian, a Jesus follower, you are a fulfillment of that prophecy 2,000 years ago. So I wanted my kids to understand the significance of this. In fact, it's interesting, in the 16th century, a guy named William Tyndale, who you've heard of, came along, and he decided to translate the Bible from the original languages, Greek and Hebrew, into English. He was the first one to translate the Bible into English from the original languages, Greek and Hebrew. And when he was translating the New Testament, he got to this statement, and on this rock I will build my ecclesia. And he looked at that Greek word, and he looked at the Latin Vulgate, and he looked at the German translations of the Bible, and he went, wait a minute, they all say church. This is ecclesia. Ecclesia doesn't mean church. A church is a building. A church is a location. Ecclesia is congregation. So in the first English translation of the Bible, you do not find the word church. It's not in there, because William Tyndale got it right. It was congregation. That's what he put. On this statement, I'm going to build my congregation, and nothing's going to stop it. And throughout his New Testament, it says congregation. Well, the church, the powerful church, the Roman church at that time, did not like his translation of the Bible, especially the New Testament, because it took all their power away. Because I say, no, the foundation is the church. He's going, that's not what Jesus said. He said it's going to be a gathering of people. And they arrested William Tyndale, and they strangled him, and they burned his body. But he was exactly right. And all over the world today, all over the world today, there are many different pieces of real estate, and there are many different kinds of buildings, and there are many styles of worship. But they are all part of the prediction. They're all fulfillment of the prophecy that Jesus made right outside the walls of Jerusalem when he said, I'm going to build my gathering, and nothing is going to stop it. And you, we are part of that. So we're standing out there in this dusty area. I'm saying to my kids, imagine it. And they're like, Dad does this stuff all the time. But I'm going, isn't it just amazing? Isn't it amazing that the church survived Rome in the first century? So then a few days later, we hop on a plane and we go to the magnificent city of Rome. And I'm saying to my kids, now imagine this. Okay, now we're in the second city. Imagine that. The Apostle Paul was arrested in the city we just left, Jerusalem, and he was, arrested by Romans, and he was put on several boats and several mules and several hikes and walks, and he ends up in this city, 1,500 miles away by flight. And the Apostle Peter, on his own volition, left Jerusalem and traveled to this incredible city, the city of Rome, to visit the Christians and to visit the churches in Rome, because in his lifetime, amazing, in his lifetime, the lifetime of Peter, not hundreds of years later, an oral tradition, and people just made this stuff, but forget that. Within Peter's lifetime, there were so many Christians in the city of Rome that he went there to visit, was eventually arrested and crucified, tradition tells us, upside down, which is not unrealistic, because the Romans didn't necessarily crucify people right side up. They just would pin them to trees and to scaffolding and all kinds of things. Now, just to try to bear down on the significance of this, okay, then I'm going to move on. We'll get to the sermon. I want to ask you a little history question. This is a little history question, okay? And the answer is not Nero. So I'm going to go ahead and not let you make a fool of yourself. The answer is not Nero, okay? If you, with confidence, could come up here and say into a microphone the name that I'm about to ask you, then I want you to raise your hand when I ask the question, okay? Here's the question. What was the name of the Roman emperor? What was the name of the Roman emperor when Peter went to Rome to visit the churches in Rome? How many people could stand up with confidence and tell me his name? Two history teachers. Yep, that's about it. Now, let me tell you why that's an important question. When Peter went to Rome, everybody in the Roman Empire knew the name Emperor Claudius. But nobody knew the name Peter. And now, all over the world, all over the developed world especially, everybody knows who St. Peter is. But you couldn't find a person in almost anywhere that could give you two sentences of information about Emperor Claudius. That's the significance of Jesus' statement when he said, I'm going to build my church, and nothing is going to stop it. So just in case somebody ever asks you about Claudius, a little information about Claudius, okay? Claudius was married four times. His fourth wife, Agrippina, the fourth wife, watch out. The Agrippina, his fourth wife, actually had a son who from her earlier marriage named Nero. And so she poisoned her husband, Claudius, the emperor, to make sure that her son, Nero, would become the next emperor because he was thinking about putting one of his other kids from another marriage up there. So that's how it all went. And then Nero grew up and became emperor, and then guess what he did to his mother? He poisoned her, had her put to death. Actually, there's several stories about maybe how he put her to death. So it went on and on and on, but who cares? In fact, when we think of Nero, we think of either a dog or a Christian persecutor. He's like a footnote. He is a footnote in the story of Christianity because there on that dusty hillside in the middle of nowhere, Jesus says, guys, you may not believe it. Let me tell you what I'm going to do. I am going to build a congregation. So on our trip, we went through the Roman Forum, you know, and this is where Julius Caesar was, and Caesar Augustus, remember in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree. Caesar Augustus is like a footnote in the story of Jesus, and, you know, Claudius, and then right over here to the right, you can't see it, is the Palace of Tiberius. Tiberius was the emperor during the time when Jesus was crucified. He was the one who had Pontius Pilate arrested and brought back to Rome for trial. Then he died before he got there. I mean, there's all this history, but look at it. It's ruins. It's just ruins. And yet all over the city of Rome, in fact, you can't see it in this picture, but on top of this building is a cross. And all over the city of Rome are crosses, and their crosses not to commemorate crucifixion. Their crosses to commemorate a single crucifixion of a Jewish carpenter from Jerusalem, 1,500 miles away, that never went more than 25 miles from home. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's the power of Jesus' statement. And that's the church. And that's what we're a part of. I'm telling you, it's just fantastic. So for our trip, you know, I'm telling all these stories and I'm trying to make my kids interested, you know, Jerusalem and then Rome. It was a lot of fun. Now, here's the interesting thing about all that. Because of the English Bible and because of William Tyndale being put to death and because of the power of the Roman church, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, an unfortunate thing happened. The term church in Western culture, and maybe for you, the term church in Western culture has come to mean a location. That even though Jesus didn't predict a place, he predicted a people, for most Westerners, church is nothing more than a place. So we say things like this: I go to church. I went to church. I didn't like that church. And in the first century, if someone had said something like this, this wouldn't even have made sense because the church wasn't a location. It wasn't something you went to. It wasn't something you attended. It was something you were a growing part of. It was the ecclesia of God. But unfortunately, because church is a location, church is a time slot, church is a weekend activity, unfortunately for some of us and for many of us, we've lost the idea. We've lost the idea of what Jesus predicted and what has actually happened all around the world. So when we started North Point Community Church, that became all of our Atlanta churches and churches all around the country and now all around the world, from the very beginning, we wanted to capture the essence. We wanted to capture the essence of what Jesus meant when he said, I'm gonna start or launch a gathering of people. And we decided we were not going to be content to put people in rows. And even though we built some big buildings and we have lots and lots of people in rows, and even though I love talking to people in rows and my career is all about keeping people awake in rows, you know, we knew from day one that this isn't the essence of the church. This is part of it. This is part of the church experience. But it's not the whole church experience. In fact, I would say this. If your only experience in a local church is sitting in rows, you've had a bad church experience and you didn't even know it. You've not only had a bad church experience, you've only had a partial church experience. Because the church is not simply about rows. The church is about a growing, gathering, relationally nurturing group of people. In fact, when you open the New Testament and you look at those parts of the New Testament that were written to the church in the first century, here's what you find. The primary activity of the church was one anothering one another. The primary activity, you can read it for yourself, Paul's epistles and Peter's epistles, and James wrote a letter to the church. It's, if you read it, you'll find the main activity, when they talked about what is a church supposed to do, there's almost nothing about this part. I mean, there's the assumption that you'll meet together because it'll say, when you meet, so hey, we're meeting. The assumption was that we would do communion, but it doesn't tell us how often or how to do it. The assumption was that we would sing because they sang in the first century, but they didn't tell us what style, how many songs, what the volume should be, you know, who should get to pick the music, you know. There was the assumption in the New Testament church that there was teaching or preaching, but they didn't tell us how long to preach. We know that one time Paul preached a sermon, and it went so long, a guy fell asleep in a window and fell out and died. So we try to keep it just south of that, you know? And we have people fall asleep, but we haven't had any injuries, and we don't let you sit on the edge of the balcony for that very reason, you know? But other than that, all we know is that in the church, they had communion, but didn't tell us how. They sang. We didn't know anything about the songs. Got a few lyrics scattered through the New Testament. And they preach and they teach. But then when you ask the question, but what else did they do? Throughout the New Testament, it's 90% relational. They one another. Here's what it says. It says forgive one another, accept one another. That's hard, isn't it? Care for one another. We've talked about that. Encourage one another, submit to one another, bear with one another. You know what that means? It means that you're going to meet some people in a local church that you're not like them and they're not like you, and you think they're wrong and they think you're wrong, and then you think, gosh, we're all going to be in heaven together. We better bear with one another. We may be neighbors someday, right? Restore one another. You know what that means? That means that people in the church, because you're going to be in these relationships, they're not going to do what you thought they should do, and they're going to fail, and they're going to sin, and they're not going to be consistent, and they're going to lie. And then we got to make the decision, what do we do with them now? And all throughout the New Testament says, well, you don't abandon them. You don't push them out. God didn't push you out. You restore one another. You carry one another's burdens. And then the one that sort of drives all the one another's is the big one. Love one another. What is the church supposed to do? Well, this is part of it. This is the easy part of it. This is the organized part of it. This is the part you can come in here and not even pay attention and walk out and get in your car and go, well, I went to church. As if God's going, check by your name. Bonus for you at the end of the year. You get a B+ on that test you didn't even study for because you went to church. Good for you. But you open the New Testament, there's none of that kind of thinking. That the primary activity of the local church was one another, one another. Jesus said it best when he said this, and this is a verse we looked at a lot. Remember this? By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples if you attend, if you sit in a row, if you sing along, if you give. No. He says, here's how they're going to know. I mean, they know who belongs to the temple of Jupiter by who shows up at the temple of Jupiter. And they know who belongs to the religion that worships Diana and Isis and all the rest by who shows up at the temple and leaves a sacrifice. But here's how they're going to know you're my follower. It's not a location. It's not a weekend activity. It's bigger than that. It's more attractive than that. They're going to know that you're my follower by how you treat one another. Now, here's the challenge for us, and here's why we just camp out on this week after week, year after year. You can't one another in here. Now, there's some awesome people in the parking lot that one another you on your way in and one another you on your way out, and you don't one another them back because you have a bad attitude half the time, okay, because they won't let you park exactly where you want to park, and they're standing in the way, and they're one anothering you. They're caring for you. They're organizing you, and you don't one another them back because we're not really designed for that on the weekend. There's some incredible people back there one anothering on your preschool and your children and your middle school, and they come back in the afternoon, and they one another on some high school kids and restore them and forgive them and teach them and love them. But for the most part, when you show up at a weekend service, we can't even do the primary activity of the church. This is important. This is part of it. But it's just one part of it. But let's be honest. Most of us, most Westerners, most people who attend church on Sunday give themselves credit for being a part of a church if they sit in a row and endure the message and the music till the end. And the worse the message and the music, the more credit they think they're getting with God, right? It's like Bart Simpson said, his favorite time of the year, or his favorite time of the week is the minute after church because it's as much distance between that and the next time he has to go, right? It's like if it was terrible, God's really giving me credit because God's going, I didn't like it either, you know? But you open the New Testament, that's not the local church. It's the one another. Now, if that's not convincing enough, this next statement by Jesus, I couldn't even exaggerate for you. I couldn't even exaggerate for you just what a show-stopping statement this was for the people in Israel and the people that were a part of the Jewish tradition and were celebrating in the temple and doing temple worship. Here's what Jesus said. This just shows you how extreme this is. He says, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, now let me just stop right there and put this in context. He says, therefore, he's talking to people who are his followers, okay? This isn't for everybody. These are Jesus followers. He says, if you're one of my followers and you're trying to do the whole God thing correctly, and you're on your way to the altar, which means there's a lot of, you know, backstory with this. It means you've purchased the right kind of animal to sacrifice. You've got the spotless lamb, or, you know, you got a kid, or you got the older one, or you got the right number of pigeons, the right kind of pigeon, or you have a grain offering. So you've spent some money. You've gone to some hassle. You know, there's been some hassle involved. You've got your offering. You finally make it to the temple. You get through the Gentile gate. You know, pardon me, excuse me, pardon me, excuse me, pardon me, excuse me. You get through the gate of women. Pardon me, excuse me. And the men, you finally get in there. Then you get in line. You get in line, and you're waiting in line, you know, for your turn at the altar to sacrifice your animal to, you know, make peace with God. That's how they did that in the, you know, Old Testament, right up to the time of Jesus. He said, so you're in line. You've gone through all the hassle. You've gotten there, babysitter for the kids, told your husband you'll be out later. You don't want him to know what you're sacrificing for. So you're in line. He says, and you get right up, and it's your turn. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there you remember that your brother, and that's not your physical brother, though it could be, it's just your brother, the person you have a relationship with in the faith, you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift in front of the altar. Now, when they heard this, it was like, whoa, 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 what? Like, I know it's my turn. Okay, will you save my, I say, wait, you guys go on ahead, but I'm going to leave my pigeons. Will somebody watch my pigeons? Because I got to go make peace because I have this thing at work. We kind of left it unresolved, or my husband and I had a fight, you know, or I lied and I haven't taken responsibility, but I don't want to lose my place. Can I get a ticket? Because I, do I have to get in the back of the line? Jesus says, this is what a big deal this is. If you have a relational challenge that you haven't resolved, don't kid yourself. Don't kid yourself by thinking if I show up and sit in the row and show up and sing the songs and hear the sermon or leave my sacrifice at the altar, don't kid yourself into thinking that you can have things, you know, perfect with you and God while you're mistreating other people. Don't kid yourself. That's how it works in all the other temples. That's how it works in all the other religions. Not with my people, not with my gathering, not with my congregation. They're going to know your mind, not by how consistently you sacrifice, not by the fact that you waited in line and were on time, not by the fact that you brought the right kind of offering, but by the fact that you loved one another. Here's how he finishes up that statement. He says this, first, go and be reconciled to your brother. Then come offer your gift. That's extreme. Now, it's kind of complex. So I came up last night. I was working on this. I thought, I want to make it simple. So here's what Jesus was teaching. He says this. Go one another your bro before you sit in a row. I think that's what he was trying to say. Go one another your bro. If there's some one anothering you need to do, some loving, some forgiving, some restoring, some reconciling, you need to go do that first before you come sit in a row and look so religious. He goes, no, I know that's different. But this is my congregation. This is my gathering. Jesus knew that in all of religion, the gravitational pull in all religion is always toward compartmentalization. For all religion, here's what I mean by that. That I can be fine with God, it doesn't matter how I treat you. That me and God are cool. You know, I prayed and said my prayers and read my Bible and put 10 bucks in the bucket. You know, me and God are fine. I hate her, but that's different. I can love God and hate her, can't I? And Jesus would say, well, in all other religions, yeah. In fact, in other religions, you can actually offer me enough of a sacrifice or offer your God enough of a sacrifice to get your God to do something bad to her. You can, like, gang up with God against her in other religions. Not my people. Not my congregation. In fact, before you sit in the row, you need to go make peace with the person you have unresolved conflict with, especially if it's your fault. And especially if you're to blame, and especially if you're the one that created the conflict. Now, my point in all of this is this. That's how relationally rich Christianity was intended to be. That's how relationally rich following Jesus is supposed to look. That's why the primary activity of the local church is not this. This is part of it. If this is all you've done, you have had a partial church experience. But the life, the richness, the wealth, the growth, you know, the passion, the emotion is around one anothering.
So grab your note sheet. How are you doing in your relationships? Part of what we believe at Eastlake is to attend a church, to be a part of a church body, won't empower you when it comes to the things that matter in your relationships. I mean, it's great to come and be a part of it, but what you'll discover when you come here is that just being at church won't empower you. The whole purpose of this is not to somehow have church cause something for us. The whole purpose of this is to experience Jesus. In fact, it's my relationship with him that empowers my relationship with other people. Now, why start a church? Why have a church? Why be a place where people could come? There was 10 people that started this church. There's about 70 now. Don't let this fool you. This is the least church the 10th weekend of the year after Thanksgiving. But why have a church? Here's why. Because at the church time is the first step for some people to even be able to experience Jesus. This is how the Bible says it. It says in Ephesians, it says, their responsibility, talking about church and leaders, their responsibility is to equip God's people to do his work and build up the church, the body of Christ. So what it's saying is, like the disciples, when Jesus was around, he had a group of people with them, and they would watch Jesus, and they didn't know how he did the things he did. They didn't know why he even did the things he did, but they knew this: if I can just get my friend in his presence, if I can just get my relative, if I can get somebody from my family, if I can just get them into the presence of Jesus, everything happens. And now, it's the church. It's the body of Christ. If there's somebody in my life, if I could just get them into the presence of Jesus, everything happens. Now, church is way different, but it isn't way different because of morals or ethics and the rules that we have. That's not it. In fact, if you get a large group of people together, you just get a big group of people together, and you can call a church if you want to, but they're not experienced Jesus, it'll just gravitate towards the worst. There'll be gossip and backbiting, and people will put other people down, and they'll be image conscious. And, you know, just being in a large group and in a building, this is our new building here, and we're going to do something about this light eventually. We got a place for the kids. We just started out here. It's a young church. We're just starting. So that's great. We have a church building now, and that's fantastic. And you can call it a church. But if there is not an experience with Jesus, actually it devolves into the worst, not the best. I mean, it's all about having a relationship with him. Now, you might be thinking, but Robin, you don't know my friends, and you don't know my family. I mean, they are so far away. Look here, a place in the Bible. This talks about, Jesus said this when he was talking about it. He said, and upon this rock, going back to the idea that he's the Christ, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. So here's what happens a lot of time. You come into a church gathering like this because it's been a long time. And by the way, as I've talked to people, here's what I've discovered. Very few people have a beef with Jesus, but a lot of people have a beef with church. They've got something in their background. They've got some experience. They've dealt with somebody that went to church. Now they don't want anything to do with church because there was some negative thing that happened, and then God gets put on the back burner. So that's why we say this is a church for everyone, just to take a first step. And so, you know, you have somebody in your life. You come here, and you start to experience him. And then before you know it, you're like, gosh, I can see other people in my life. I wish they could experience it too. And then you think of all the stops. No way. And when Jesus said the gates of hell shall not prevail, here's what he's saying. There is no gate that can stop me. What relationship do you have in your life and it's broke down? And you just feel like there's a huge gate there, maybe even a wall. It's a high gate. It's a locked gate. It's a strong gate. The gates of hell, even the gates of hell are not strong enough. And so if there's someone in your life you think they're so far away, they'll never, ever respond. Whatever the gate is, it's not strong enough to keep them out. If they can experience the body of Christ,